the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, and this morning we speak first with one of the world's premier underwater explorers, Jill Heinerth. She's the first person to dive inside iceberg caves in Antarctica. On April 22nd, which is Earth Day, Jill will speak at the University of Utah's Kingsbury Hall as part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series. And then we'll speak with Ingrid Daubar, project staff scientist with the Europa Clipper mission that's on its way to study Jupiter's intriguing and icy moon. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
The Natural History Museum of Utah presents its 2025 lecture series. It will explore water on Earth and in space. And our next guest, Jill Heinerth, leads a compelling lineup of explorers and researchers who will present at different venues throughout Salt Lake City. Jill Heinerth is one of the world's premier underwater explorers and the first person to dive inside iceberg caves. Wait until you see this. Filmmaker James Cameron says about Jill, more people have walked on the moon than have been to some of the places Jill has gone right here on Earth. Jill's also the author of the best-selling book, Into the Planet, My Life as a Cave Diver, and the focus of the new documentary, Diving into Darkness. She will speak at Kingsbury Hall on April 22nd at 7 p.m. You must look her up. You must get tickets. Jill Heinerth, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I actually looked up a term in the FCC to know if I could use it on the radio. It's the first time I've ever wanted to say that you are such a bad at. Where did this come from, this drive in you to explore sort of the middle of our Earth?
I was always that curious kid and loved the water. And as a child, like, we used to go to a place called the Bruce Trail here in Southern Ontario, a long trail network that winds its way through this limestone escarpment. And there are caves and little crevices and cracks to crawl around in. And that ignited my imagination as a kid. But to be able to swim through these spaces, even better.
It's just incredible. Okay, I know the word claustrophobia is not in your vocabulary, but no. Can you talk about that particular phobia? I think most of us have it at some to some degree.
Yeah, no, claustrophobia is fairly normal when you're shocked by seeing what I do. But I was that little kid that built a fort in the cupboard underneath the kitchen counters or in the top shelf of the closet. Like, I've always loved those cozy, dark spaces. And for me, when I'm diving in these underground spaces, it's like swimming through the veins of Mother Earth. It is absolutely transformative to me. And the science that we can do in these spaces is incredible.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking with one of the world's most premier underwater explorers and the first person to dive inside iceberg caves, Jill Heinerth, and she is part of the Natural History Museum of Utah lecture series. Well, Jill, just like we were saying, claustrophobia, I was looking at some of your videos and images, and I just freeze up because it scares the bejesus out of me to even think about going down there, because a lot of people around here have been scuba diving, where you're looking at pretty plants and fish, but you can always look up and see the surface. Not so with what you're doing, right?
Mm-hmm. No, we're working in a completely overhead environment. So as far as you go into the earth, you've got to be able to deal with everything in place and remember that you have a return trip to get back to the light of day. But, you know, these caves are like museums of natural history. You know, they carry so much important information that makes it worthwhile for me to take these types of risks. It's not for adrenaline. It's for data. It's for science. It's for learning about Earth's past climate, about ancient civilizations that have left behind artifacts, about discovering the biology within these unique spaces. And for me as an artist, bringing back images from places that I think are stunningly beautiful.
Yeah, your images are amazing, looking at the website for the documentary and your book. But as you're exploring, you know, we were recently talking with, well, we've been talking with the people from the Europa Clipper mission, and of course they can't bring back stuff from there. But in the environment that you're exploring in, granted, they're very different ecological conditions than what you'd find on the surface, but can you actually bring samples back without them being damaged or affected by the change in environment?
Yeah, I work with many different types of scientists as their eyes and hands in an environment that they can't get to, because my specialization has really been in the technology, the life support, and, you know, 8,000 plus dives that have helped me to refine my craft. And it's much like the way an astronaut does experiments for people back on Earth. You know, we collaborate together. They specialize in the science, and I become their hands and eyes. So yeah, there's so much that we can do, either bringing back actual samples or even artifacts in some cases when permitted. But we're also utilizing advanced technologies to image things in place. So we scan objects like fossils and artifacts, and we create virtual reality and even augmented reality holograms to enable us to leave those things in the environment where they're fairly well conserved, and then just bring back the data to scientists.
Wow. So aside from diving into these iceberg caves, and by the way, we can see this amazing background on our Zoom call right now of one of those iceberg caves, I'm assuming. What are some of the other places that you dive to in the name of science?
Yeah, I dive in places where a lot of people would never imagine someone would go for a dive trip. So underneath the Ural Mountains in Russia, beneath the Sahara Desert, on the border between, you know, Libya and Egypt, inside active volcanoes in lava tubes, and limestone caves all around the world.
Wow. Who knew that there's water underneath the Sahara Desert, for example?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. We just think of this as this dry place, but beneath Egypt, Libya, Chad, and Sudan is the largest fossil aquifer on the planet, meaning there is fresh water trapped beneath the desert, but it's a fossil aquifer because it no longer rains there, so it's no longer replenished if we withdraw water from there. So it's a really important water source, and one that deserves protecting.
Can you go a little bit deeper into, I think you said something like the history of our Earth and of our water. If you're diving into places where we're never going to see that water, what are the interesting kinds of things that you find?
Mm-hmm. Well, in one case in the Bahamas, we're actually looking at the rock formations, the speleothems, those beautiful stalagmites and stalactites within the cave. Because inside the stalagmites, those are deposited when the cave was dry, when ocean levels were lower, when water tables were lower. So rain would drip from the ceiling to the floor in a cave and just create these formations, literally one grain of calcite at a time. But that means that these depositions happened in layers that we can look at later, much like the way dendrochronologists look at tree rings or people look at ice cores and count back in time. And so in a cave in the Bahamas, we can count back 450,000 years. We can see four times in Earth's history when these caves were dry, so when the ocean levels were lower. And that's just the geology. Like, I love the biology too. Animals that live their entire life in the blackness of an underwater cave and have unique survival strategies to do so.
Well, Jill, what has been your longest dive? I would say days, but you don't see the sunlight. So how many hours was your longest dive?
My longest mission was like 22 hours. So a pretty significant mission. When I was working with the United States Deep Caving Team and Dr. Bill Stone, creating the world's first accurate three-dimensional map of a cave system. And this was back in the late 1990s. But we developed all this technology for a private project, and for the first time in history could not just define the 3D space where, you know, your drinking water is running through, but also how that relates to the surface topography. So we were also pinging our position from inside the earth, helping to register that map to what's on top. So I've cave dived underneath a Sonny's barbecue restaurant, underneath a bowling alley, underneath a golf course community, underneath an industrial park. And when you make that connection and you realize that everything that you do on the surface of the earth is going to soak into the ground and be returned to you to drink, it's a pretty profound connection to make.
Well, I was reading that you are a pioneer in the technical rebreathing science. So you're down for 22 hours. That's 22 hours worth of air, and I'm assuming hydration and food. Mm-hmm. What does that look like to, what do you take with you for 22 hours? Mm-hmm. It's not like you're going to pop to the surface and have a quick snack.
No, we're actually using a very advanced form of life support technology that's quite similar to what an astronaut uses for a spacewalk. So it recirculates your exhaled breath, capturing everything that would have normally been bubbles if you were normally scuba diving. And then we're rejigging that life support mix for deep depths, adding helium, adding oxygen when the body metabolizes some. So it's a really interesting technology. But that's not the only thing I have to take along, because anything that goes wrong has to be dealt with in place. So on a dive like that, I would have about 500 pounds of gear, a mapping device, a backup scooter, two rebreathers, several extra scuba tanks, a scientific diving package, carrying all that into the environment, in addition to like a dry suit that keeps me relatively protected from the environment, and then food and drinking water and things that you would need to deal with that long exposure. And diapers, of course.
Oh, there's that.
There's that. Yeah, that's the number one question, actually. Truly, is the first question people ask me. How do you do that?
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just fascinating to hear from you. And of course, you have a very hazardous career. Are you covered by life insurance at all? Or are they like, no way, we're not going to take this off?
Not a chance. Yeah. No, I mean, it is sobering to reflect on the fact that I've lost more than 100 colleagues in the course of my career. It's a very, very dangerous undertaking that requires significant training, good equipment, and a lot of redundancy, as well as good health and being current in your skills. All of those things come into play. But it is worth noting that most fatalities can be attributed to decisions that were made before the dive. So that means it's preventable with diligent attention to safety protocols. That's not going to prevent every death, but probably 90% of technical diving fatalities could be changed by better decisions made before the dive.
That is so interesting. I recently read that book Deep by James Nestor. He would probably say, and you might, that at some point we were equipped to be underwater for a lot longer, very long, in fact. But when you come out of a cave and you're surfacing, how long does it take to surface, or has everything been accounted for?
No. So when you go underwater, the deeper you go and the longer you go for, then you're going to pay a penalty on the way back up. You have to slowly reacclimate your body to the surface pressure again, or you can suffer from something called decompression illness or the bends. And so those slow stepped ascents are mandatory. I mean, literally, you know, you could have minor injuries, but decompression illness can also kill you or paralyze you. So it's very, very important to follow those protocols. And decompression can take, for me, like that 22-hour dive, 17 of those hours was just the slow return to the surface, altering the breathing mix as I go.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, so Jill, you were the first explorer to dive into iceberg caves. Short mm-hmm. of the temperature differentiation from probably your normal areas of diving, what other special preparations and plans did you have to make to do that dive, do those dives?
Yeah, that was a really interesting project, going to Antarctica, making a 12-day crossing of the Southern Ocean from New Zealand to the Ross Ice Shelf to intercept the largest iceberg in recorded history. It's like four times larger than the one that everybody's talking about now, A23. So the iceberg was called B15, and it was the size of Jamaica. But nobody had ever done this before. So how do you prepare to do something that hasn't been done? Like, there's no handbook for the first person. So we researched everything we could, but had to learn on the fly and continue to, you know, review our risk assessments after each dive, after we'd learned something, because these are dynamic, changing environments, incredibly dangerous.
Well, I remember years and years ago reading in National Geographic about a series of caves that connected, I think it was the mainland America to the Yucatan Peninsula, and these divers had gone in and they'd spend hours and then they'd pop up into a chamber and then sleep overnight, I guess, if you will. And then same kind of thing. Have you done a dive like that where you've popped up into an open chamber? And when you get there, do you just rip your mask off and take a big deep breath?
No, so that kind of diving is called sump diving, where you travel through a dry cave for a distance, and then you get to a point where you can go no further without going underwater. So then you go underwater and dive and surface in another chamber. But that air is not always breathable. You can't count on that. So it depends on many different factors. Like, you could have trapped methane gases underground, and if you ripped off your regulator and took a big gulp, that'd be your last. So sump diving is dangerous, not just because of those air quality issues or because you can deplete the oxygen and suffer from carbon dioxide issues. But it's also just so remote. You might as well be on the dark side of the moon. Like, there is nobody coming to get you. The best people to save you in the event of an accident are already in the cave with you.
Wow. We're speaking with Jill Heinerth. She's one of the world's premier underwater explorers. And she's coming to Salt Lake City to speak at Kingsbury Hall on April 22nd. She'll be speaking at 7 p.m. That's Earth Day. And you have to get your tickets. Get them now. She is the keynote speaker for this speaker series that the Natural History Museum of Utah is presenting, and it's all about exploring water on Earth. So, Jill, it's going to be really exciting. Tell us about what the attendees can expect to find and to hear.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's going to be a very dynamic, fast-paced presentation because I have a lifetime of photos and video clips to share from all around the world. And I'm going to share some of the excitement of the different sciences I've been involved in and the people that I've worked with, as well as my philosophy, or what I call the explorer's mindset, which I think everybody can sort of take away something from that mindset and bring it into their lives, like being ready to step into the darkness and chase your curiosity. So very excited to share all of this with our friends in Utah.
I just have to ask, I'm sure everyone asks you this, how does your family deal with what you do?
I am the only diver in my family, and so that means there's a lot of explaining to do around the dinner table. So, you know, frankly, it does worry my husband especially greatly, and I give him veto over my projects and try and, share as honestly as I can about the risks that I face, and he's very proud of me and supports what I do. But yeah, it's difficult to explain to people that don't dive or don't want to take those risks in their lives.
Or who are incredibly claustrophobic and get the shivers when you talk about it.
Actually, that is my husband. He can't even change the oil, because getting under the hood would make him feel claustrophobic.
Well, Jill, as you have dove all over the world in these underground spaces. What are the commonalities that you find? Because, you know, the surface of the Earth is so incredibly diverse. And again, short of an iceberg, are they all fairly similar?
Well, the caves all look quite different, which is fascinating. Like, people ask me, why do you keep going and looking at wet rocks? And some can be like crystal palaces. Like, there's a place we call the Glass Factory in the Bahamas. It's so beautiful. It just looks like a room full of hanging icicles, and it's stunning and warm, clear water. But here, closer to my home, in a cave in the Ottawa River, the visibility is very low, like 1 to 2 feet. And people might wonder why I would want to dive there, but it's full of the richest mosaic of biology I've ever seen in an underwater cave. So even one with poor visibility is worth visiting and worth studying because of the science that we're getting out of a place like that.
This is going to be hard to answer because I can tell that you're so excited about everything that you see and discover, but do you have a favorite discovery?
Yeah, no, it's so tough because the favorite is always whatever I'm working on now. Although I have to say the work I am doing close to home here in the Ottawa River is very meaningful to me because here I am working in my own watershed and helping to understand these filter feeding organisms that are cleaning the water for us, something that's incredibly important to me close to home. So that you know, local relevance is especially important. But I would say the most beautiful places I've ever been are underground in the Bahamas and Bermuda.
So nice. Okay, I keep thinking about this dry suit that you use when you are diving into iceberg caves. Dry suits only keep you so warm. Do you have some other supplementary sort of heat source that you wear inside your dry suit?
So we wear very technical undergarments. Some people will wear heated undergarments run by a battery pack that's outside the suit, but it adds pounds and pounds, you know, more to what you're taking underwater or what you're flying around the world. So I've just acclimatized to dealing without artificial heat and just sticking with really good technical undergarments. But yeah, it's not exactly comfortable, but it's worth it. It's tolerable.
You're even more brave than I previously thought you were doing that. I mean, just dealing with cold. Darkness is one thing. No air is another, but being cold. Oh. You know, you talked about aquifers and I know you're a big climate advocate as well. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about these filtration systems that hopefully filter out what comes onto the soil and comes through and potentially affects our aquifers, do you have hope? Are you dismal about it? Are you, you know, what's your overall thought on that?
I'm still an eternal optimist because I feel like when people are armed with knowledge that they can make better decisions in their lives. And so I feel like I'm that vehicle. I'll share a lot of adventures and beautiful pictures, but I'll also shove a little truth in there too and hopefully help people to understand the unintentional impacts that we're having on the water planet through our activities. And I'll share some of that at the museum as well.
Well, Jill, of all the places you've been, they've been diverse and fascinating and extreme. Is there some place still on this planet that you want to explore that you haven't had a chance to yet?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really looking forward next year to going to Galapagos for the first time. And that's pretty exciting for me.
I wonder if it's going to be as diverse underwater as it is above water.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, tell us about your movie. I was looking through the movie that came out, Diving Into the Darkness. Mm-hmm. I love the subtitle, Never Cave Into Fear. Well, that's yes. Easy for you to say. Tell us about the movie.
It's a documentary about my life made by an Australian film company. And we'll have a streaming announcement very soon. In fact, I may be announcing it at the event in Utah. So we're pretty excited to finally get this out into the world.
That's so exciting. Okay, so it's April 22nd. It's Tuesday. It is Earth Day. And our guest, Jill Heinerth, will be speaking at Kingsbury Hall on the University of Utah campus. It's at 7 p.m. You must get tickets. I just want to mention that the rest of the lecture series are, those are all free, but being who she is, Jill Heinerth, she's the keynote and an amazing speaker. And oh, we're all going to love it. So Jill, thank you so much for previewing your talk with us here on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks so much. I look forward to meeting you in person soon.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Jupiter's moon Europa has fascinated scientists and science fiction authors for years. As the smoothest known object in the solar system, Europa, with its fractured icy surface and possible subsurface ocean, this Galilean moon is finally getting a proper visit. The Europa Clipper is NASA's first mission to study this Jovian moon, launched last October for its 1.8 billion mile journey to Jupiter, and it will arrive in April of 2030. Here to tell us more about the Europa Clipper mission and what scientists hope to discover is Ingrid Dabar, Jet Propulsion Lab Project Staff Scientist. Ingrid, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, why Europa?
Why Europa? Yeah, good question. So Europa is this, it's this really fascinating icy moon. And we think that, as you said, we think that it has a subsurface liquid water ocean with maybe as much water in it as all of Earth's oceans combined. We're pretty sure that life as we know it requires liquid water. And so it's one of the most intriguing places to look for places that might host life. It's also got the energy source and the chemistry that we think are really promising for a habitable environment.
Okay, so you said that Europa has the possibility of having more water on it than planet Earth.
Correct.
And Europa is smaller than our moon. And Europa is a long, long, long ways away from the sun where it's very, very cold. How does that water stay liquid?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what happens is Europa is in a slightly elliptical orbit around Jupiter. And just that little bit of eccentricity in the orbit means that the gravitational pull from Jupiter, which is this massive, massive planet, it changes over time. So the moon Europa ends up getting kind of squished over its 3.5 day orbit. And that squishing in the interior, it's actually causes friction. And that's enough to maintain this vast ocean and to keep it liquid.
Wow, that is amazing. Ingrid, I'd love to go back a ways in history to when, you know, Katie in the intro said a Galilean moon. So it was discovered first by Galileo. And even he thought that there could possibly be life on this moon. What did he see then? And how long have we known that it has all of this right, the right chemistry, the right water, and the right energy source to possibly, or really potentially be the place that has in the solar system that has a potential for life?
So what Galileo saw was really just a point of light. He was able to see Jupiter itself in his telescope. And then he saw these points of light that changed their position over time and were clearly orbiting Jupiter. So this is the first observation of a body that was not orbiting the sun in our solar system. So that's kind of led to this whole Galilean revolution that we are not the center of the universe. Those points of light were fascinating for lots of reasons, but it wasn't until we actually sent a spacecraft there, the Voyager spacecraft in the 70s, that we got to see it up close. And since then, several spacecraft have flown by and given us additional data. The most recent one is the Juno spacecraft, and that gave us even more information. But the observations from these spacecraft that were able to go really close is what led us to the conclusion that there has to be a liquid, salty, briny ocean beneath that frozen surface. And we know that because of the magnetic field. So Jupiter, this massive planet, has a really, really strong magnetic field. I think it's like 20,000 times stronger than the Earth's or something like that. And Europa is passing through that magnetic field all the time. And it actually induces a current within the ocean. So we can detect that. And we know that there has to be some sort of conducting fluid under that solid surface. And the most likely scenario for an ocean world is a liquid briny ocean.
So it's my understanding that this ocean, or what we think is this, it's under ice. And sometimes this ice appears to be about 18 miles thick. Is that right? And I mean, how is that detected and discovered?
Yeah, so it's one of the ongoing questions that scientists have debated over the last few decades. We don't have a clear understanding of how thick is the ocean itself or how thick is the ice shell covering it. Estimates have varied between a few kilometers to hundreds of kilometers thickness for that ice shell. How thick that is does affect the geology and how much there might be material being exchanged between the ocean and the surface. So it's a question we really want to answer, and that's what one of the many things that we're hoping Europa Clipper will help us answer.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking with project staff scientist Ingrid Dabar, and we are talking about the Europa Clipper mission. All right, so on the first, just in a couple of days, the little Clipper is going to swing past Mars to help it get a gravity assist boost on its way to Jupiter. How does that work? How are you utilizing this planet to propel the Clipper?
Yeah, so these gravitational assists that the navigation engineers have designed, they've been used for all kinds of different missions. And basically what we're doing is we're stealing a little bit of Mars's gravity. So we're flying by and we're using that that gravitational field to help us aim eventually towards Europa.
I was reading that the Clipper has the most sophisticated scientific instruments yet deployed on a mission. And there's some amazing things. Like Lynn was just talking about the 18 mile thick ice. There is an ice penetrating radar. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So REASON is the name of the ice penetrating radar. And it's going to tell us so much about the subsurface. It's going to basically bounce radar waves off of the surface and the subsurface, and then detect what comes back to the spacecraft. So by doing that, we'll be able to analyze subsurface structures. Like, for example, maybe there's a pond of liquid brine within that ice shell that might be communicating with the ocean and the surface. REASON will be able to detect that. And it will also be able to tell us things like, what is the nature of the surface? How rough is it? What's that topography? Like, are there mountains and how tall are they? You mentioned it's the smoothest body in the solar system, but there are some really interesting bumps that geologists are really interested in too.
Ingrid, you are with JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab. You're a project staff scientist. I have seen these rooms where, for example, on the Clipper's launch back in October, they have video of when it goes right and when there's the launch and various steps that you all are so excited about. And you see like 25 staff scientists, I'm assuming, with various jobs. The excitement is palpable, and it's always at that point that I wish I worked for JPL. But can you describe what you do specifically?
Sure. So I'm a project staff scientist on the Europa Clipper mission, which means we're a small group that basically helps try to organize the whole science team. So we interface with all the different instruments and all the scientists that are located all across the US and some in other countries. Up until launch, we tried to make sure that the whole spacecraft and the mission was going to be built and designed to do the very best science that we possibly can.
Wow, it's so exciting. So Europa Clipper launched last October, and it won't get to its final destination to Europa until 2030. That's a long time, but it is, oh gosh, I've forgotten how many billions of miles away.
Yeah, it's a really long time to wait, but it's still relatively fast for the outer solar system. You know, some of these missions take decades just to get there.
Really so exciting. And so what will be the information gathered and how will it be gathered in terms of, you know, what types of cameras, you mentioned the radar that can kind of see through ice, but what other types of devices and engineering is there to capture the information you want?
Yeah, Europa Clipper has 10 different scientific investigations on it. We're going to be observing this moon in all different wavelengths, from the UV all the way to the radar. We have a thermal imager. We have a suite of cameras that's going to get visible images in color and stereo. And then we also have a suite of in-situ instruments that will actually sample the material around Europa. Some of that material gets kind of kicked off the surface by little micrometeoroid impacts. And there might also be, there's some really tantalizing evidence that there might be plumes at Europa where material is actually being ejected from the subsurface. And if those are there, we're going to be able to find them. And if we are lucky enough to fly through one, we'll be able to sample that material and see what that subsurface ocean is made out of.
Earlier, you mentioned that Jupiter has a magnetic field 20,000 times that of Earth's. And that causes a unique situation for the Clipper as it orbits Europa. Tell us about how you had to plan Clippers orbiting around the moon.
So it's a really punishing environment out there. It's so much radiation that it would just basically fry all the electronics if they were unshielded. So we actually don't orbit Europa itself, because that would mean just staying in that really heavy radiation environment. We're orbiting Jupiter and kind of diving into that high radiation environment to do a really quick flyby of Europa, and then coming back out to kind of recover and send all the data back to Earth. So that was the reason for designing it as this multiple flyby mission instead of an orbiter.
Europa orbits Jupiter every 3.5 Earth days, if you will, I guess. That's fast. So how fast will the Clipper be moving as it's orbiting both Europa and Jupiter?
Yeah, we're basically going to be screaming by the surface of Europa. You know, all these instruments are designed to work together, and they're all going to be focused on the surface of the moon as we fly by, and we're going by at like kilometers per second. So it's designed to gather that data really, really quickly and then use the time away from Europa to send it back to Earth at a more leisurely pace.
So exciting. Okay, Ingrid, if you're no longer with this project, where are you? And
sure, yeah.
And why are you giving this interview?
Yeah. So I had a dual appointment for a while, and I was at JPL, and I'm also an associate professor at Brown University. So I'm still affiliated with the project. I'm still involved, and I've been on that project for 10 years or so.
10 years. So you really feel like, I mean, this is just a huge part of your life. Do you find, since you're also a professor at Brown, how you turn on other people to this project? I think because in some ways, like, we can talk about it here on Cool Science Radio, but it's so unfathomable the types of distances and the time it's going to take. I understand how you're so excited about it and you make us excited about it, but how does the general population get excited about it?
Yeah, that's something that we do our best to try to communicate that excitement to the public. And we, for example, we had a tour. We went to a bunch of different aquariums across the country, trying to connect, you know, the science that we're going to do about this ocean world in the outer solar system with the oceans of our own world. And that was really great to make those connections. Another thing we do is we actually I've had a couple programs where people could actually send their name to Europa. So we have a microchip on a special plate of metal called the vault plate. And that microchip has, I think it's 2.6 million names of Earthlings who wanted to send their name to Europa, actually etched on that microchip. And also on that plate, this is kind of our Voyager golden record, our kind of message out into the cosmos. We made a lot of connections with the human side and the humanity that has influenced and inspired this mission. One is a very beautiful poem written by Ada Limon, the National Poet Laureate. There's a great recording of that online. I encourage your listeners to go listen to it because it's really inspiring. And we also have etched on that plate the word for water in hundreds of different human languages. And your listeners can also go and they can listen to all of those. So again, you know, we're trying to connect and make it clear that this is humans building this and inspiring this. And this is us going out there to Europa.
In reading about the Clipper itself, this is the humans built the biggest planetary spaceship so far. And it's, what, the size of a basketball court than when the solar panels were fully expanded?
Yeah, it's massive. The solar panels are huge because we're so far away from the sun that there's really not a lot of sunlight there to power this spacecraft. And like I said, there's 10 different science investigations. We got to send all the data back. It takes a lot of power to do all that. And we don't have nuclear power. We have solar power. So these are the biggest solar panels I think ever built.
And then we mentioned earlier that you're using Mars as a boost to get to Jupiter, but when you get to Jupiter, you're going to use another moon, Ganymede, to help slow it down. I mean, short of slamming into it, how do you use a gravity assist to slow down a craft?
Yeah, I think Ganymede is one of the first things we're going to be able to look at when we get there, even though Europa is our prime target. And we're going to kind of swing by in much the same way that we are Mars and the Earth in 2026, I believe, to kind of adjust that trajectory and get us in exactly the right place to observe Europa.
That'll be so amazing. So when we talk about other life that there is potential for, what are we looking for? Are we looking for something microbial, even that big, or something smaller, because it will most likely be in the water? Does that change what it would be? I mean, I assume it does, since our life in the water is much different than life on land. You know, what's the expectation or the hope, or, kind of the thoughts around it?
We're limited to look for the kinds of life that we know about, right? That's kind of our limitation. There could be other kinds of life out there, but the kinds that we know about are, they're carbon-based. They require organic molecules. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to be looking for. Are there organic materials that could be the building blocks for life as we know it? Is there an environment conducive to that? So if there is life there, we might or might not be able to detect it depending on what form it takes. But we will be able to say whether that environment at Europa is conducive to life, whether it could have formed there and might even be extant there now.
What could go wrong? Not to be a pessimist, but what are some of the big things that, that the team worries about?
Oh my gosh. Well, lots of things could go wrong. And engineers spend their careers worrying about each and every one of those things. So the engineers on this mission are just amazing. And they have spent decades trying to make this mission as robust as possible because, yeah, things can go wrong and we can't send a mechanic out there to fix it. So, the radiation environment is something that we're very worried about. We've put a lot of shielding on the instruments and tested things under different radiation environments. But of course, we're going to be monitoring that and keeping an eye on it through the mission. There were issues with the Galileo mission with its antenna not deploying properly. We have now deployed Europa Clipper's antenna, and we're confident that it works. So we've gone through a number of different checks to make sure that all the subsystems are working. That was kind of the first thing after launch. We deployed the solar arrays and the antennas and make sure everything is working. So we're going to be doing a number of checks like that all the way there. One of the reasons we're excited about the Mars flyby is that we'll be able to check several systems that could not be checked on the Earth. The radar system Reason is huge, and it's got a lot of components that are so big they couldn't be tested on the Earth. So we're going to be able to test all of those things in concert for the first time when we get to Mars.
In reading about these amazing scientific instruments, you have the Europa Imaging System, and I'm sure there's a great acronym for that as well. And it's going to provide the highest resolution images of the surface. What are they hoping to discover from just seeing the surface of the planet?
Yeah, so the Europa Imaging System, or ICE, as the acronym is two different cameras that are very, very sensitive, and they're going to be able to get very close in and very far away imaging. Those really close in images are going to be really fascinating because, so I'm a planetary geologist, so maybe it's fascinating to me and not everyone, but it's going to be able to tell us really the nature of what that surface is like, the textures there and what that's composed of, and how that ties in with the geology. Like we know the surface is being bombarded by impactors all the time, right? It's just everything in the solar system is. We'll be able to see the tiniest little craters that are forming today. So I find that very exciting personally. And it's also going to be really valuable information for the future because hopefully someday we might be able to send a lander to the surface of Europa. But in order to do that, we really need to know what is that surface like? Is it going to be weight-bearing? What kind of lander would we have to design to land safely on that surface?
In addition to looking at craters and ice, you're also looking for infrared light to determine the composition of the surface. I mean, these are just amazing instruments. And so how are you going to use infrared light to determine what it's made of?
Yeah, so there's a really detailed spectrometer called MISE flying on Europa Clipper, and it's going to take spectra, or basically look at the reflected light from the surface of Europa. And the specific details of how that light is reflected tells us what that surface is made out of. So we're really interested in the ice itself, but also the non-ice materials that are mixed in with the ice. So you might have seen images that are kind of stretched to bring out those color differences in the surface. We think those color differences are due to materials on the surface that are being actively exchanged with the subsurface. So if we look at the surface, we might actually be able to tell what's coming from the ocean as well.
This is a bit of an existential question, Ingrid. But as you describe this thing to us, like what it does, Europa Clipper and the whole mission, the whole project seems kind of otherworldly. It seems very unfathomable, but you work with it every day. And so my question is, how much does it amaze you that we figured out this, but we haven't figured out something like how to repair someone's spinal cord? I mean, I just have to ask that because I think about those things all the time.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, all these different fields of science are complementary. When we think about the advances in technology that have been developed in service of space exploration, a lot of those have also benefited us here on the Earth. For example, things like GPS that we all use on our phones every day, that's also necessary for space exploration. So there's a lot of complementary benefits between different fields of science and technology. I don't think it's an either or. I think we can do both. We can fix people's spines and we can go explore the universe.
I love that answer. Thank you for that.
So Ingrid, you are a planetary geologist. Is this the most exciting planet, if you will, to go look at or space body to look at? Because, you know, you got the moon, pretty basic. Jupiter, you can see into the inside of what the geology looks like. But here's Europa. You've got to be really excited about this.
Well, to be fair, I also study the moon, and it's also really interesting. But yeah, it's a hard question to ask a planetary scientist. What's your favorite planetary body? but certainly, you know, Europa is in some ways the most dynamic and the youngest planetary body that we have the opportunity to study. And a mission like this really comes along only once in a career. So personally, I am super excited to get to Europa and to see basically all the new questions we're probably going to have as a result of all this cool new data.
And you are now you're a professor at Brown University. What are you doing there?
So I'm a research professor at Brown University, and I work with a lot of students studying planetary geology. We have had a couple projects related to Europa, but I also do projects related to the moon and Mars and asteroids. So pretty interdisciplinary projects. My favorite kind of planetary process is impact cratering, and there are impact craters on all of these solid bodies. So I get to study lots of different places in the solar system.
That's great. You know, there's been a lot of activity around the moon recently. What is going on there that you are, I should say, not the moon, our moon, because that's what Europa is too. Yeah, our moon. What are you working on there, and what is going on that you're excited about?
Well, so the moon is a really exciting place right now. A lot of new missions are going to study it. We're actively preparing for human exploration with the Artemis missions. A few projects that I'm working on are looking at impact craters on the moon to see what they can tell us about the nature of the surface and subsurface, and what that tells us about not only the impact cratering process, but also like what is the moon made of and how does that inform future exploration?
That sounds really great. Well, you know, you're so specific with what you personally are working on, and yet you've been able to talk really broadly on this. Here's another really broad question. What's the price tag on all of this? I mean, you've been spending you've spent 10 years of your career working on this. Any idea?
Yeah. So, I mean, these missions they're not cheap, right? But The entire planetary budget is a fraction of 1% of the US budget. So it's important to remember too that this money is not, we're not actually sending the money into space. We're paying mostly American scientists with taxpayer dollars to do this work and to share the results with the American public. So all of the data that we return is going to be public, and that will be available to study for, you know, generations to come.
And Ingrid, it's not just Americans that are involved in this. What are the other agencies that you have partnered with?
Yeah, so there's another really great mission called JUICE that the European Space Agency is also sending to the Jupiter system. And coincidentally, we're going to be there around the same time as Europa Clipper. So it's really great to think about what kind of synergies will we have. You know, the instruments are complementary. They're going to be a little bit different, but we might be able to look at the same places on Europa with different instruments and really work together to get really great collaborative science.
Well, our guest today has been Ingrid Dabar. She is a project staff scientist and planetary geologist with the Europa Clipper mission, and it's on its way to Europa, which is a moon of Jupiter. Well, Ingrid, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We look forward to having you back when we get more exciting data in 2030, 5 years.
I can't wait. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. And just to recap, Jill Heinerth will be speaking at Kingsbury Hall at the University of Utah campus, part of the Natural History Museum of Utah spring lecture series. And you can get those tickets online if you look up NHMU. And that is, again, April 22nd. It's Earth Day at 7 p.m. And another exciting bit of enlightenment and education in the science realm, Science Friday, coming to Salt Lake City on Saturday, this Saturday at 7 p.m. And that's taking place at the Eccles Theater in Salt Lake City. That's Science Friday, March 29th at 7 p.m. at the Eccles Center, the Eccles Theater in Park City. So lots of fun things coming up. We just need to keep track of them and make sure we go do it. If you would like to take us on the road with you, check us out at kpcw.org under the Shows tab and Cool Science Radio, where we keep all of our archive shows, as well as wherever you get your podcasts. KPCW Cool Science Radio. You can get all of the wonderful conversations that we've had with really astounding people in science over the years, 12 years, in fact.